Hello, podcast person, and you're a very special person if you're downloading this. Thanks for choosing this podcast. I'm John Hockenberry, host of The Takeaway, a program that's produced by WNYC and Public Radio International. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and today on the show...
I look forward to continuing to fight with all of you for the things that we believe in, for the conservative cause, because... those solutions of ours are the answer to the problems that so many people are facing today.
House Majority Leader and GOP mouthpiece in the fight against President Obama in the U.S. Congress gets taken down by the Tea Party. Eric Cantor, the purported friend of the GOP far right, was done in by his own incumbency, losing his primary in Virginia in a Washington, D.C. shocker to Tea Party candidate college professor David Bratt. We'll also look at an insurgency in U.S. education, a judicial setback for teacher tenure in California that may have national implications, and we'll also hear your tirades for and against teacher tenure. And we'll kick off the Takeaway Book Club, too, and hear the Portland Gentlemen's Club take on a novel about a lonely dentist that is a cross between Silver Linings Playbook and the Book of Job. You can decide for yourself later this hour. But first, Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. That was an 8.9 on the Richter scale last night in the Virginia Republican primary. Who is picking up the pieces today?
You might be lowballing it. Hi, John. What a shocker for the political world. Nobody saw this coming, and anybody on radio, TV, or Twitter who tells you they knew it all along just isn't telling the truth. It's a shockwave from top to bottom. Eric Cantor outspent his opponent, David Bratt, like 10-1, about 13-1. David Bratt had about $200,000 for this race. Eric Cantor, the majority leader and massive fundraiser, had millions, and it wasn't enough, John.
Bratt got 55.5% of the vote. Eric Cantor got 44.5% of the vote. It was an absolute landslide. Bratt is an economics professor at Randolph-Macon College in Ashland, Virginia. I mean, about the only data point you really have on him is he's rated on Rate My Professor, the online college rating, is 3.4 for overall quality. The student said he's so charming and really knows how to incorporate real-world examples to keep the class exciting and relatable. That's hardly a campaign strategy, but it really, really worked. What are the implications here for Eric Cantor? First of all, let's listen to him reacting to what was clearly a shocker to him.
It's disappointing, sure. But I believe in this country. I believe there's opportunity around the next corner for all of us.
So he was pretty miserable last night.
Yeah, well, you know what David Bratt did have, despite a massive fundraising deficit? He had a ton of free media. Look, the national Tea Party groups, Tea Party Patriots, Tea Party Express, the big ones that you've heard about, they did not spend money on this race. They weren't involved. But what David Bratt had was the support of a lot of AM conservative talk radio personalities like Laura Ingraham, like Mark Levin, other people who were talking up this race. That's free media, and that's radio that people listen to, and it got a lot of people out from this race. Eric Cantor also had some local political problems that were not widely reported, and a lot of people on the local scene mad at him. While he was spending quite a lot of time, look, he is the majority leader. He's got national responsibilities and national ambitions. John Boehner, the speaker, has said that he's not long for this world, a speaker of the House. Nobody knows if he's going to remain after 2014, and Eric Cantor was one of the heirs apparent. So implications, John? Look, David Bratt is an interesting figure. He still has to run against a Democrat. We also don't know if Eric Cantor might run a write-in campaign in November. It's all possible, but he's not going to be Speaker. We know that. And now the Republican leadership of the House is such a mix-up and in such disarray. That's the real question everyone is asking, is how long is it going to take the House Republican majority and the Republican Party to sort out their leadership, not only for Speaker, but the power vacuum that's now left behind Speaker and all of the people who want to move up the chain and which factions of the party they're going to represent.
This also really shows the split in the GOP. You've got the strident sort of rhetoric of the AM radio, talk radio conservatives. Laura Ingraham was all over this, as you're saying. But if you listen to David Bratt, he's right in the center of the whole thing. He doesn't really sound that extreme at all. Listen.
What you don't do is the Dream Act and all these things that sound good in the short run. The 11 million were already going back before our Congressman Cantor and the rest of the Democrats announced that they're going to let kids stay and come in. Now there's a whole new wave coming in due to Eric Cantor's policies. And so that's where we are. And those signals incentivize the wrong behavior.
I think it's fairly clear to say that immigration, Cantor was something of a champion of immigration, is stalled in the water here.
It was stalled before, and now it's double stalled. Dead before, now it's double dead before November. I don't think there's any question about that. As people try to unpack and tease apart what this loss was really about for Eric Cantor, immigration is part of it, but only a small part. Look, nobody who's for comprehensive immigration reform thought before yesterday that Eric Cantor was a big ally. It's true that he did favor what a lot of people have come to call, you know, aspects of the DREAM Act, but that's only a very, very narrow part of comprehensive reform, letting children who came here at a very young age, if they're illegal, stay in the country. That's only a very small facet of it. It was a way in for David Brat to criticize. But John, the most interesting thing in my view about this is that Eric Cantor, going all the way back to 2010, is one of the architects, one of the designers of the recruitment effort for the Tea Party revolution and the conservative revolution. And so it's the purity of conservatism that came and bit Eric Cantor in this race. Not only immigration, David Brat criticized Eric Cantor for not doing more to defund and repeal Obamacare, even though they had 40 votes on the House floor, for giving up, for voting eventually to end the government shutdown. It was the purity that Eric Cantor helped foment to propel the Republicans to the majority that eventually becomes so difficult to manage for somebody who also has national leadership responsibilities and national leadership ambitions.
Todd, you have 15 seconds. Do the Democrats have a play here with David Brat being a relative unknown?
The Democrats have a candidate. His name is Trammell. He's also a professor at Randolph-Macon College.
I love that.
Look, it's a Republican district, but Cantor had huge name recognition. We have to wait to see if he does it right, and it's a total toss-up at this point.
Todd Zwillick, takeaway Washington correspondent on Eric Cantor shockingly losing the Republican primary in the state of Virginia.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
So is it suddenly a new world for California teachers? A Los Angeles Superior Court has struck down California's teacher tenure and dismissal laws. The decision was championed by Secretary of Education Arne Duncan, and our next guest, who fought for the plaintiffs in this case. Joining us is former Washington, D.C. Schools Chancellor Michelle Rhee, founder and CEO of the nonprofit organization Students First. Michelle, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thank you so much.
So is this a crack in the tenure armor nationally for teachers?
I think this is an absolutely huge win for public school students across the country. It really is saying that they deserve and they have a right to a high-quality education. And as part of that, a first step is ensuring that there's a highly effective teacher in every classroom in front of them every single day.
If this decision is upheld, and I suspect there's some sort of appellate review here, what freedom will management in schools have because of this decision that they don't have now?
Well, I think what the courts are saying is that the current laws and policies as they stand are not doing right by kids, are disproportionately negatively impacting poor and minority kids specifically. So what it is an opportunity to create a new paradigm, a framework for the teaching profession that ensures that we can elevate educators, but at the same time really make sure that there are protections for children. So the court is saying that these things are unconstitutional, but what the court is not doing is saying what should take its place, and that's where the hard work is really going to lie.
But theoretically, I mean, you could do like a corporate Six Sigma sort of program that every teacher would have to be measured according to very specific achievement metrics, test scores, attendance, these kinds of things, right?
Well, I think that's what we want to move to. We want to move to a system where we don't have protections in place that ensure that people have a job for life regardless of performance. You know, teachers do absolutely need some protections. There's no doubt about that. But right now it's too skewed towards a situation where grossly ineffective teachers can actually stay in the classroom. And we need more of a balance in a new system.
Respond to one of our listeners, a teacher speaking from Raleigh, North Carolina. I will be a first-year teacher next year. I'm already seeing an exodus of great teachers from North Carolina after the removal of tenure. The ones who are staying are ones lacking experience, like myself. Bad teachers with tenure can be removed. Good teachers without tenure have no job security from year to year. What's your response to that?
Well, the reality is that tenure to date in the public education system has been serving as a job protection for life regardless of performance. It's incredibly difficult to remove ineffective teachers from the classroom. And what this case showed is that grossly ineffective teachers have an incredibly negative impact on kids. In fact, there was a professor from Harvard University, Tom Kane, who testified in the case that kids lose out on about almost 12 months of academic growth if they are in an ineffective teacher's classroom versus just an average teacher's classroom. That is the kind of loss that we absolutely cannot stand for and that kids can't afford to have in their academic lives.
Let me explore that data point there for a moment. They lose a year of growth in terms of test scores, grades. I mean, how would you actually measure that year of growth?
Academic growth as measured by standardized test scores. And one of the things that we have to realize is that we are moving towards a system now where teachers are being evaluated in a much more rigorous way based on multiple measures, things like observation of their classroom, performance, their contributions to school community, but also how much their students are actually gaining academically in a given year.
Michelle, you make some great points, and I think I can see both sides of this argument. But I'm wondering if, in process terms, if the courts are a dangerous way to approach this, because it's going to create a really divisive kind of defensive situation where teachers feel under threat in state after state after state. And would this be much better handled as a legislative matter, either at the federal level or within states?
Well, a lot of states have been handling this at a legislative level, and it's just as controversial in those states. So I don't think that the court doing it is any less controversial or more controversial. I think that the reality is that whenever you shake up a system, whenever you change fundamentally a system that is more focused on the adults and job protections and privileges to one that is focused on the rights of students fundamentally, to ensure that they're getting a high-quality education, you're going to have some pushback. But I think it's important to note that in the case, there were many, many teachers who testified on behalf of the plaintiffs saying that they did not feel that it benefited the teaching profession overall to have these kinds of laws and policies in place. For example, one of the policies that the case addressed was the policy of last in, first out, which means that in the time of layoffs, it's the teachers who are the newest teachers who have to be laid off first, regardless of performance. And, the reality is that that kind of policy doesn't make any sense whatsoever. If we are in the unfortunate position where we have to lay teachers off, then we should do so by quality, by their effectiveness, by how much value they're adding to the classroom, as opposed to just based on their seniority alone.
And teachers all over the country, teachers, parents, and students all over the country will be watching the implications of this decision in California. That is absolutely certain. Michelle Rhee, thanks so much.
Absolutely.
Michelle Rhee is the former chancellor of Washington, D.C.'s public schools and the founder and CEO of the nonprofit organization Students First. What do you think about the court's decision? What do you think about the issue of tenured teachers in public schools?
We are moving my fourth grade son to a private school next year because when one complains at our public school, nothing happens. Or worse, in our case, the school flat out refused to make any changes. These schools are for our students. The children's education should take precedence over these antiquated laws.
From Selden, New York, I've been a teacher for 20 years and I still stay after and bring hours of work home daily. I have students that don't care. I am judged on their performance. People call me lazy and constantly tell me how easy my job is. Job security is the only thing going for this job lately. Take that away, and there will be a lot of people leaving this profession voluntarily. What do you think about tenure? You can join this conversation or any other conversation on the program. Have your say at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You're our insurgents out there. You can follow us on Twitter, at The Takeaway, all one word, at The Takeaway. planet Earth is just one revolution away from the start of the 2014 World Cup. Soccer, football, call it what you will. But here to help us understand what's going on is Rupert Allman, executive producer of The Takeaway. What are you doing here?
Five golden rules, John, about being a true soccer fan.
And we need to explain this in the middle of the NBA finals and the NHL finals because...
This is not to take away from any of those fantastic sports.
Glad you said that.
Just to say the fact that, as you know, soccer, football is huge and there are generally five golden rules.
To being a good fan.
It's exactly that.
All right.
Let's start with number one. Not just a game. Anyone who tells you that it's just a game, treat them with derision. You talk later in the show about book club, the search for religion.
Yeah.
For a lot of people, football, soccer, very much is a religion.
And that is true because...
Because basically we're kind of, you know, slightly faithless in most of Europe, so therefore we're looking for something to hold on to.
This isn't like the movie Castaway where he talks to the ball, right? No.
You can do that sometimes.
Yeah.
Number two, a true fan who knows the World Cup, they follow the same rules as something like the Open or the Derby. It is the World Cup. It's not the Soccer World Cup. It's not the Football World Cup. You've got to just say the World Cup.
Okay.
32 teams, and this is what will go down well, I think, probably in America, is the fact that there has got to be just one winner. And that is the drama that we'll see in the next 4 or 5 weeks.
Right, well, that's not unique to soccer, but it does put all of these countries in this huge, almost United Nations kind of competition, right?
True. And like other sports, it has its own language. Rule number three... It has its own language. Make sure you get the words right. There are no quarters, no timeouts. There is no playbook. The spot kick, it's called a penalty. The score, if it's 0-0, and by the way, love a 0-0. You can have a great game which is 0-0. There do not have to be goals. 0-0.
0-0.
It's not 0-0. It is not zip. Zip is something that fastens your jacket.
So 0-0.
If I see the linesman, it's more accurately described as the assistant referee. There is no linesman. It's the assistant referee. They are there basically for making sure they don't get the offside rule wrong.
Okay.
But here's the thing. Rule number four, no one understands the offside rule.
Right.
Okay?
So I'm like most people in the world.
A player is offside if he is closer to the goal line than both the ball and the second-to-last defender. Oh, and he has to be in the opposition's half of the field. To be offside, a player must be in front of the ball and have fewer than two opposing players between himself and the goal line when the ball is played to him by one of his teammates.
And this was written in Beowulf originally now, or the Magna Carta?
Is that clear? No.
No.
And that is the point. It is not clear. There is no technology. And because no one understands the offside rule, it gives us so much more to talk about at the end of the game in the pub.
And so much more reason to drink.
Exactly. Drinking is kind of de rigueur. It's not compulsory. And certainly some of the responses I had to this segment on Facebook, I got a lot of replies, most of which are unbroadcastable. But drinking did feature fairly heavily about being a true soccer fan.
But that's not one of the golden rules.
No. The final golden rule, though, is rule number five. Accept the sport at the international level is run by an organized crime syndicate with an infallible leader who at the moment is causing death in the Middle East and saying anyone who doubts his integrity that they're probably racist. The problem here is the FIFA, who runs the international sport, they make the IOC look good. It is the ugly face of the beautiful game, and the more you look into how FIFA works, the uglier it gets. Sepp Blatter makes Donald Sterling look like a man of probity. The one thing you've got to realize, though,
his name is Blatter.
The one thing you've got to realize is that as soon as the game kicks off, all this knowledge about FIFA and how it's run is wiped from the collective memory.
The death in the Middle East thing, we can get rid of that, though, right? That might be a little much.
I refer you to some articles about the way that the game is being built in Qatar at the moment and the fact that you've got a lot of people in problems.
I just don't want big FIFA thugs coming in here and dragging me out into the streets.
It might happen.
Oh, no. Well, that would be exciting.
Sure.
Let's get some video.
Enjoy the game.
Okay. Chapter 1, page 1. Let's begin.
The mouth is a weird place. Not quite inside and not quite out. Not skin and not organ, but something in between. Dark, wet, admitting access to an interior most people would rather not contemplate. Where cancer starts, where the heart is broken, where the soul might just fail to turn up.
That's Max Wall from Portland, Oregon, getting us started with the story of To Rise Again at a Decent Hour, a novel by Joshua Ferris.
I loved it. I thought it was
interesting in terms of the interpersonal relationships. Ferris has a real way with humor, and he has a real way with setting a scene with very minimal description.
Max is one of the gentlemen in the Portland's Gentlemen's Club, a real book club founded by another gentleman, Tim Sands.
I love the book pretty much from the first pages. It started off, you know, pretty funny and then got into a lot of searching and came to a good end.
I enjoyed the book a lot. I thought it sort of told two different stories to me. One was the search that this guy was having, Paul was having, for who he is and how he can find his way. And at the same time, there was a little bit of the mystery aspect in it.
And that's one more of our Portland gentlemen, John Lohuis, on the book To Rise Again at a Decent Hour by Joshua Ferris, the first book in the Takeaway Book Club series, where every month we'll pick one piece of fiction to read and discuss. Today's book tells the story about Paul C. O'Rourke, a successful New York dentist who is lost, lonely, and kind of miserable. Not a typical navel-gazing story, more of a molar-gazing epic. Paul O'Rourke's passion is being a Boston Red Sox fan, which doesn't cut it as spiritual wisdom. His search for truth is a fairly dismal series of relationships with women of different religions. These don't go well. And in a twist, religion finds him when someone steals his identity online and draws him into a search for the roots of a bizarre, ancient, or possibly cult religion. To Rise Again at a Decent Hour was a great book for this trio, whose interests include mathematics, music, the law, fly fishing, and, of course, their book club.
It was a good excuse for us. We've got some new fathers. We've got a bunch of lawyers and journalists and writers that we wanted a good place to get together and drink whiskey, wear funny hats, and actually kind of use a little bit of intellect to have, a common cultural heritage book-wise. So we've been getting together for about 4 years. We usually have food, drink, beer, and whiskey are popular. But the food varies. You know, we're not trying to start an arms race like some book clubs where everybody ones up each other, you know.
Another great thing is, this is Max, another great thing is that, like Tim picked a book this past time that I would never have heard of. And it's a real chance for us to expand reading, because there's books that I would never have in a million years thought of reading that these guys have picked that have been great books.
This is an example of that for me, To Rise Again at a Decent Hour, and thanks for letting me in on your club and all of our listeners. We've got a few who already have some comments on the book. What do you think Joshua Ferris is getting at here with this story of a dentist on a search who's very conflicted really is sort of lost in the universe?
For me, I think the narrator is just trying to find his place in the world. You know, he's a pretty successful dentist. And outwardly, he's got all the signs of success. You know, he's got a nice place in New York, and he's got money to go out and grab great meals. But
Curry
at the same time, he's just a lonely guy. He can't relate to anyone in one of the busiest cities of the world.
You know, and John, one thing that hit me too is that it's almost like he has his wheel of life, but he's trying to find one spoke to carry the entire wheel. And it's that kind of searching throughout, whether it's looking at religion or his iPhone, his me machine, what's going to carry him through life. And he keeps trying to find some sense of community, at least was my takeaway, I guess, that by the end of the book, by joining with this other kind of religious non-religion, but he's still able to have that sense of community, that sense of togetherness, meeting with people, talking about things, and a group to be together with. And in a way, it made me think a lot of our book club. This is our way of having fellowship and community and meeting with each other. So the notion of finding commonality with other people, even if it's through fraudulent websites, it worked for me.
Yeah, it wasn't so much about the religion for me. It was just another way that he was able to develop his own sort of sense of identity and self and kind of find his place in the world.
Well, you know, he finds the religious experience in the oddest places. I want you to just know that there's a member of your club now from Grand Prairie, Texas, and this is this person's reaction. The book really pointed out how separated we are in spite of the great number of people on the earth. Interesting how people want to be a part of something larger than themselves, just what you were talking about, whether it is the Amalekites, a fan group, or an internet group. People sure are disconnected despite always being connected to their me machines.
Yeah, and I think that theme was one thing that jumped out at me right away, really just the satire and emphasizing how flimsy technology is as a way to connect, you know, that somebody was able to steal his identity by just going online, starting a website, and all of a sudden that person is Paul C. O'Rourke, you know, and so how how kind of flimsy that technology is for establishing those sorts of contacts. There was a lot of emphasis on that point, and it's very true, and it's something we're the first generation to have to try to navigate, is how do you work that sort of flimsy technology in a way that you actually get something foundational and something real in community. And that's not a resolved question, I think, at this point.
No.
And so it was an interesting thing to bring up in the book.
One thing I noticed with what Tim was talking about was, at least with the advent of things like Facebook, I've noticed that I'm having more communication with people, but it's of a more shallow nature. You know, we're having quick text message conversations. We're not having lengthy discussions. I've started trying to write more real letters in an attempt to try and see if I can deepen my conversations. It made me think a lot of, there's a guy named Bo Lozoff who started the Human Kindness Foundation. One thing that Mr. Lozoff really professed was that the answers are the deep and simple. The problem is that the world that we're living in is shallow and complex. And that kept coming back to me as I was reading the book, that he's living in this world that is so one thing to the next, second after second after second. And what he really needed was deep, simple connections with people.
And yet each time he tries that, you know, he messes it up. And it's almost hard to read, and especially in the first part of the book, because every time he gets into a relationship, it's just like, oh, come on, Paul. Like, you want him to do better, and yet he doesn't repeatedly.
And you know, one thing I noticed, John, you know, when I was reading through this, there's a section where he starts defining himself not as Paul, but as Paul who loves Connie, all in dashes, all one word. And I actually, this is the first book in a while that I've had to stop several times and think about what I'm reading, because it was causing me to think so much about myself and be introspective, which is a little unusual for me. And that once he's in love, he loses a sense of self, and that takes away from your partner whatever they had to love about you in the first place. It's like they're looking into a mirror. And I can think of at least one relationship that I've ruined that way. And so for me, it was kind of a, oh, yeah, moment. And like, oh, well, I need to make sure I don't do that again.
Yeah, and I think Max hits on a good point there that, you know, hopefully, you know, no one who's reading this, I think, identifies 100% with everything about what Paul's going through. But I think there were so many just great elements of Josh's writing that, like, I mean, I think everybody who's read it that I've talked to has found at least one or two elements where you're like, I absolutely know, you know, that lotion tirade. Like, I understand, you know, where he's coming from on there. And, you know, and I think we all react to it differently. But I think some of the plausibility of the story gets bolstered by the fact that, you know, that there's at least a couple elements where we can all say, I've done that, you know, maybe not as 100% as Paul does, but it was very relatable, I think, in that way for me.
Give me a hint of the lotion tirade.
Well, there was one of his exes who he was gripped by quite strongly was putting on lotion. He spent, I think, probably 10 minutes just staring at her until she kind of called him out, like, what are you doing? And he's like, oh, I wish at some point you would have taught me about lotion. And she's like, there's nothing to teach. You just put it on, you feel good. And he won't trust it. And he keeps, and that seemed to be kind of a theme. He keeps wanting to try to dissect everything to the point where he can really, in a very rational way, deal with it. And, you know, I think the one of the things he gets to is that by the end, you don't get happy by dissecting and understanding perfectly everything. You get happy by letting it go, you know.
Well, and Tim, one thing I noticed too is that he's so cyclical in terms of his superstitions, and he has to do the same thing every time the Red Sox are on, and he has to walk out in the sixth inning, and he has to eat the chicken and rice, mm-hmm. and he has to do everything a specific way. And in a way, it's like compartmentalizing his life to the point where he's not actually living anymore. And by the end of the book, when he finally gives in to trying something new or having experiences, that to me, I mean, it was very uplifting to me at the end. And I didn't expect this to be an uplifting book in any way at all.
Here's a woman listener from Normandy Park, Washington, Gina Howell Forbes. I found the book to be a fascinating character study of a psychologically troubled middle-aged man. I loved his growth and his increasing understanding of himself throughout the story. I spent a good deal of time wondering what psychiatric diagnosis could be applied to him. I did a little of that. And what sorts of treatment might benefit him. I did not like the ending of the book at all. I felt I wasted the time I'd spent reading the book when I got to the end and nothing was resolved and nothing really changed for him. I'm hoping that by listening and reading the discussion, I can figure out what I missed. Can you help Jenna here?
Well, you know, I think that what I felt was so hopeful at the end is that he has realized that he doesn't have to be this person that he's stuck being anymore. You know, he can go. He's still going to do the charity work in Kathmandu, and he's able to help people out. He's able to have a human interaction with these children at the end, and he's able to just give it a go and try hitting the ball in cricket. You know, I'm flipping ahead here, but he says when he realizes that he doesn't have to root for the Red Sox, he can root for the Cubs because they're even more of a failure.
He loves suffering.
That's the religious point. I mean, is rooting for the Cubs a religious, spiritual upgrade from rooting for the Red Sox? Does it involve more faith?
I think it depends upon what your faith is based on. If your faith is based on, yay, we're the top, you know, you go root for the Yankees. But all good Americans hate the Yankees, so I think that the Cubs
not controversial at all.
if you're rooting for the Cubs, you're rooting because you want. I mean, you want to be like Job. You want to put up with all of the suffering because at the end of the day, if that's what brings you joy. But it's the notion of, he said, you know, the world knew again, something to desperately want. I went inside, and when I came back out, it was on my head, where my Red Sox had been for years. And he swings at the cricket bat, and he says, what the hell, I thought, what the hell, and without any expectation or understanding, doubtful of any hope of success, I swung, one eye on the ball and one eye toward heaven. And to me, that says, whether it's baseball or cricket, you take your chances, and you may have doubts, but you still take your chances at the end of the day. And by actually moving forward and doing something and not just thinking about his superstitions, he is able to, I think, begin to overcome those superstitions and begin to still have doubts, but to move forward in his life. And that, to me, was why it was so uplifting. Well, I don't know if you fellas have any other ideas.
No, I mean, but I don't want to give out too many spoilers, but I did like the way that the book wrapped up. I know that there's various opinions on, you know, how crisp and clean an ending should be. But, you know, this one, for me, didn't seem like he went through some vast transformation and, you know, enemies become friends and friends become enemies. It was a little more, I felt, subtle and realistic. So the ending to me suggested he went from Paul O'Rourke, you know, depressed all the time, to basically the same Paul O'Rourke, but with some small changes. And that scale, I think, is something that he hadn't done in his life, that everything seemed to be complete replacement of his identity.
That's right. Yeah, he's doing volunteer work overseas. It sounds like he's gone and done that a few times, and he's gone with one of the people that he works with. And it seemed to me like he had developed a pretty good friendship with that person. It sort of developed some mutual respect. And then, you know, he's in the streets of Kathmandu, and he sees this kid with a great smile, and he realizes, oh, that's the work that I've done. You know, I've made a difference in someone's life. And he kind of gets outside of his own head. And to me, that was pretty uplifting.
Well, and I thought too, John, that the interesting thing to me was his kind of realization, I think, that identity is fluid. I mean, you can make yourself into what you want to be. You can, you know, create your own Facebook page, your website, turn yourself into who you want to be. And if you want to be a Cubs fan, I guess that's okay.
And there was the throw quote about, you know, the greatest gift man has is the ability to raise your life by conscious endeavor. And I think, you know, once you get that mindset, then you're right. I mean, I think there weren't any, like, actual relationships we pointed, like, here's his new best friend and here's his, you know, new love interest and here's that. But he's at least got the ability to have that momentum change. And I think that's as hopeful as you can get for a lot of cases.
So what do you think? Should we keep going with this book club thing? This is pretty cool.
Heck yeah.
Yeah.
It's great.
Yeah. And like I said, I mean, you know, just getting, you know, it's getting harder and harder with the internet to get everybody kind of on the same page, you know, no pun intended. So, you know, having people kind of commit to doing that has been a great thing for our community, you know, here in Portland, but also nationwide. I think there's a lot of good opportunity for it.
Well, and who knows, maybe you'll get some hors d'oeuvres FedEx to you from Grand Prairie, Texas, or Normandy Park, Washington, or Central Massachusetts.
Yeah, it is possible to ship barbecue, and, you know, if anything's coming from Texas, that would be a welcome thing.
Well, Tim Sands, Max Wall, and John Loheis, thanks for talking about Joshua Ferris's To Rise Again at a Decent Hour. It's been great.
Thanks, John.
Thanks very much, John.
A big thanks to the Portland Gentlemen's Club, our first book club in our ongoing book club series. And when they aren't reading books, here's them playing some bluegrass music.
He's got a smile that it seems to me reminds me of childhood memories when everything was as fresh as the bright blue sky.
And we want to remind you how to take part in this book club project of ours, not their band, although they'd be happy to have you. You can nominate your book club by visiting our website at thetakeaway.org. And even if you don't have a book club but want to read along with us, you can find a list of the books we're reading at thetakeaway.org. Our next book is Sleep Donation by Karen Russell. It's an e-book only, so take a look for it. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Reputation.com, encouraging everyone to check their online search results because search results define you or your business. Learn more at Reputation.com. TiVo, recording up to 6 shows at once and 3,000 hours, plus Netflix, Hulu Plus, and YouTube, all on the TiVo Romeo DVR. TiVo.com. The Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.